As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Right, we're just a few weeks away from our first ever live edition of the Race F1 podcast on February 12th. So far, we've got a great venue, King's Place in London, as part of Pod Live. We've got me to host, Scott Mitchell-Malm to give lengthy answers, and a very special guest in Ted Kravitz. So Ted, we've got to work out what we're going to talk about. What's there to look forward to in 2023 that we can get into in the live show, do you think?
Let me start by telling you a story about Murray Walker. There you go, good start. He always used to say at the beginning of a season, you know, Formula One has an amazing ability of reinventing itself year by year. And I used to think it's a funny thing to say, but you know, the more I think about it, the more he's right. And even though we don't have new cars this year, right, slightly different with a raised ride height, blah, blah, new tyres, we do have so many other new things that are worth talking about. We've got new drivers, we've got rookies, more than one, a couple of rookies, and we've got new team bosses. That's what I'm also looking forward to seeing how that's all going to work. And then, of course, we've got the small matter of the World Championship. Will we be, at the end of 2023, talking about Max Verstappen, a three-time world champion?
There's loads of stuff to look forward to this season. That's going to fill about 40 minutes of our 75 minutes. Scott, can your song and dance routine fill the rest?
It probably could if you would unshackle me and just let me, you know, have full creative license on it. Part of it for me that I think we can get into really nicely is the subject of rivalries, old and new, because I would like to think we're going to see some familiar fights in 2023, but we're also going to see some new ones as well. I'm really optimistic about that. So I think that's a good subject for us to get into. And obviously it won't just be us. Maybe we'll have a few interesting insights from our audience as well.
Well, this is great. The running order is coming together very, very well. I think we've got to have some kind of audience interaction. We'll definitely have a few questions. We'll have a few bits of feedback from the audience. Ted, do you know anyone who's handy with a microphone and who's good at doing a bit of broadcasting, moving around? Because we could do with someone who could go out among the people.
Well, what are we? February the 12th. Is it going to be warm enough for shorts? Yes, of course it'll be warm enough for shorts. I'll bring my pink shirt and my shorts on and I'll get down there with a microphone.
And of course, I think we should also hang around a bit at the end, say hello to a few people. Will there be the chance, Ted, to give a few autographs?
Definitely. Does anyone actually ask for autographs anymore? But we can go and meet everybody and say hello.
Yeah, it's going to be great. All part of Sport Pod Live, a live podcast festival. We're there on February the 12th. That's a Sunday. Nice early afternoon slot. So if you're an F1 fan, it's just going to be a great event to come to. Hopefully we've got so much to talk about, we're going to struggle to fit it all in. So to get your tickets, head to sportspodcastgroup.com/pod-live. That's sportspodcastgroup.com/pod-live. Get your tickets and we will see you there.
The Athletic.
The race is on, and Ford will return to Formula One in 2026 in a newly announced partnership with Red Bull. But how will the deal actually work? What does it mean for F1? And what's next for Honda? I'm Ed Straw, and joining us to explain all are Scott Mitchell-Malm and Mark Hughes. Well, Mark, great excitement. Red Bull RB19, the first 2023 car. You must have been thrilled with all the technical details we saw.
Yeah, could have sworn it was last year's car, but there you go. Maybe they're just running the same car this year because it was so easy for them last year. Yeah, it was very showbiz, wasn't it? The whole thing was just about it was very sort of, I don't wish to denigrate it, but it was very American in its emphasis on the glitz and the glamour. But there wasn't very much content there. And in terms, obviously there was a very big bit of content in the confirmation of the Ford announcement, which is presumably why it was in America in the first place. But in terms of any detail about what the new car might be, we're no further forward than we were 24 hours ago.
That was at least what we expected going into this. But I do feel a little bit sorry for all the fans who were sold this as a launch in June, and there were 115,000 odd on the stream when I looked at the numbers during it. So I'm not that keen on them misrepresenting what they're doing. I think that's a little bit disrespectful to the fan base. Scott, what did you make of it?
Well, it's just disingenuous, isn't it, when you have that, when you're claiming it's the RB19. That's the thing that I dislike. Just don't lie. Like, it's the RB19's livery. And this is the thing that I found that sort of really struck me about halfway through the launch. I was sort of thinking, we're sitting through some stuff that the vast majority, I'm not saying there won't be anyone that enjoyed it, but there'll be the vast majority aren't there to hear what a lot of that launch was. To see a car that's been mislabeled as the RB19 because it just isn't the 2023 Red Bull, to see a livery, essentially, that's all it was. But it's a livery that's well established and isn't going to be anything special. It's going to be a Red Bull livery, which is all credit to the Red Bull brand, because it's very definitive and striking. You might say iconic, those colours and that scheme. That's good. That's a testament to the Red Bull brand. But it means that a livery reveal for them just isn't going to be exciting. In the same way that if Ferrari just pulls the cover off a car at Maranello, and it's not the real car, you get that it's just going to, what shade of red and black is it this year? Like, it's not that interesting if it's just that. So disappointing for a few reasons. But when we did a piece on the website, which was sort of about like what we want to see from a launch, the big thing for me was that you make sure that everyone gets something out of it. And I just felt like a lot of that event just seemed to be do it for the sake of it, because it probably makes some partners happy. That's kind of, obviously it was a great advert for the Red Bull brand, which I'm sure is a massive, massive incentive for them. And ultimately they can spend their time and money however they want. It was just ironic. I felt that at some point in that long, long, long broadcast, there was a reference to Red Bull putting the fans first. And it just felt that launch was anything but putting the fans first.
Yeah, that's what frustrates me about certain aspects of not just what Red Bull do, but Formula One actually in general. It's one of the reasons why I have concerns with Drive to Survive when it misrepresents certain things in Formula One. It's great that it gets people interested in Formula One, but you should be being honest about what you're showing them. That's really, really important. Otherwise, it's just seems to me to be showing a lack of respect. I don't want to position myself as the voice of F1 fans or anything, because I'm not. I'm a journalist. I know my perspective is a little bit different, but it seems to me that if you're going to talk up how important your fans are, particularly with teams building their fan bases, you should be honest with them and ideally not subject them to 10 minutes of unrelated other Red Bull athletes talking about what they're doing. I'm sure all very accomplished at what they do, but just not really relevant. And I think that's the thing that really gets to me. You know, you can hold these events, you can hold a season launch event as Williams is going to do on Monday, but it's not going to be purporting to be showing their car. It'll just be a livery. So I think it's important to do that.
It was the same with Haas, wasn't it? Haas made it very, very clear that what they were doing was revealing the livery.
Yeah, I think it is also a little bit problematic when it comes to launches as a whole, because so many times I see people say, oh, you never see anything of the actual car. And actually, that's not true. Yeah, some launches are like this, and there's nothing to do with the real car, just as Red Bull's was last year. Some launches, you do get the full real car there in person. Some you get accurate renders. Some you get renders with a few key details missed. But there are real things you can look at in the car in launches that you can draw some little preliminary conclusions from and tell these technical stories that F1's always bleating about how important they are. Yet the teams and F1 as a whole seem to make very, very little effort ever to do. I know I'm getting on a soapbox here, but it does annoy me. This time of year, Mark, is great for a showcase for Formula One and the technology, and it just seems to be kind of squandered with just so much fluff.
Yeah, and I think in this case, they just tried to do too many things in one event, and they tried to make it the, you know, make it feel as though it might be the launch of the car. And, you know, there were banners saying RB19 everywhere, and, you know, there wasn't an RB19 to be seen. And there's nothing wrong with, you know, making a big song and dance about this epic bit of news that they've, you know, they've joined up from 2026 with one of the automotive giants, an American-based company, and... Sure, nothing wrong with that, and send all the fireworks up into the sky and have all that. There's nothing wrong with that. It's fine, but don't dress it up as something else. So the other the core part of the Formula One fandom still wants to know some meat on the bones, and that wasn't what today was.
The bottom line is that they did everything except launch a car. And when you do, whether you're calling it a car launch or a season launch, when you're advertising it they were advertising a car launch in some capacity, like Mark said, banners saying RB19. They made it really clear. They even explicitly stated they'd revealed the RB19. So it's just, come on, it isn't. And it's not like you had one job and you didn't do it, but it's just, it is a key part of a car launch to launch a car.
Yeah, and I think it probably is, as Mark suggested, trying to be all things to all people. You want a corporate event, you want to appeal to the US audience, et cetera, et cetera. You want to appeal to your audience back home, those who are interested in the cars, et cetera. But yeah, just be completely honest about it. And it's really important, I think, when you're pushing for new fans. Yes, the existing fans have to be treated with respect as well. But I do think we talk about the new fans and the American interest, et cetera. Well, be authentic with what you're showing them. That is really, really important, because they will recognize quite quickly if they're being misled, and that's why it's just important not to take this lightly.
Will there be just a show model or the real thing of Ed Straw when we do the race live podcast?
Well, that's a good question. People will only really know the answer to that when the wraps are taken off. Obviously, I'll be undercover at all times. Audience research has shown that it's better when I'm undercover, because people would probably rather not see me. So that's why podcasting's ideal for me. But live podcasts are a bit different. But yes, it will be the authentic 2023 spec, me at least. So that's something.
Looking low downforce at the moment.
Yep, I went with a little bit of a haircut. I was at the Race Media Awards the other day, so I thought, well, I better make some vague attempt to look halfway tidy and respectable and sensible, but whether I succeeded in that is another matter. But the really good news is, as Mark said, Ford, big announcement, and we do have launch events coming up in the next couple of weeks where we will see real cars, and we won't open up the podcast complaining about the events. But I think that Formula One teams need to be pushed to improve their launches where possible. And I do think that this Red Bull one was a particularly bad example of the genre. But let's get into it, Mark, because Red Bull and F1 have made a huge song and dance about this Ford link-up. So why is it so significant? Should F1 fans around the world be running a Stars and Stripes up the flagpole in celebration?
It's the way Ford have done it is... is not with both feet, and that never has been the way they've done it. Their F1 involvement stretches back many decades on and off, but it's still highly significant. It's it illustrates the pull that the re-energized Formula One has got with the automotives, and this is one of the biggest, of course, and it's very, very significant for Red Bull as well in terms of, from 26 onwards, because, you know, we reading between the lines, they still haven't resolved at Honda whether they were going to be in or out from 26 onwards. There's two different opposing camps there. And Red Bull can't hang around to wait to find out if the answer is eventually going to be no. So they've now got in place someone that that may be contributing some technical input with the ERS. We'll treat that with a pinch of salt for now, but I wouldn't write it off. It may come to be. But more significantly, they've got a very big sponsor and a very prestigious sponsor. And, you know, the whole thing about setting up Red Bull powertrains so that they had destiny in their own hands is a perfect justification for it. They've now got a competitor, or hopefully the competitiveness, it will be in their own hands. It's not relying on somebody else. It's not relying on the whim of a corporate board somewhere, and they get a good income from it in exchange for the rights on the naming rights.
Yeah, and you mentioned the strategy for Red Bull there. This is exactly having their cake and eating it, isn't it? In that they haven't had to give up control, they haven't had to sell bits. They've got control of their engine manufacturing. They've got the big partner with the money. That's ideal, isn't it, Scott? Even though you can't help but think they could have saved themselves a lot of trouble if they just bought Cosworth off Ford in the first place when they bought the team way back at the end of 2004.
Yeah, it is. It does amuse me that there has been this reunion in this form. And I particularly enjoyed stating at every possible opportunity in the stuff that we wrote around this that actually you've got that slightly entangled F1 history between Ford and Red Bull going right back to the mid-1990s and Sauber, when Sauber was majority owned by Red Bull and it was Ford's works team. So it's quite funny that they seem sort of intertwined so much. But I think it's good for both of them, because I genuinely think they're both the perfect partner for what kind of deal each of them wanted. Red Bull were happy to have a manufacturer on board, but it basically had to be on Red Bull's terms. Pay a load of money, we'll let you call it the engine in your name, and if you can put a little bit of technical input in, great. But the majority of this is going to be done by powertrains. We're set up to build an engine, but you do it all on our terms, basically. And there aren't many automotive manufacturers that be willing to do that, partly because, now, as Mark said, we take with a pinch of salt that Ford will have an input. But even if it's only a limited input, most manufacturers, I think, would think twice about just claiming someone else's technology as their own. With Ford, they wanted to come back into Formula One, but they wanted to do it in a right way, in a way that actually sort of made sense, was justifiable, and was sustainable and affordable. And a full works team isn't the way to do that. Even a full engine project isn't the way to do that. Look at how much money Honda has spent, hundreds of millions of dollars a year for the last, 7 or 8 years now. But there was this unique opportunity for Ford where you have an independent engine manufacturer being set up, which is such an unusual thing to exist in Formula One, because they are normally automotive manufacturers that build the engines. So there's no rival there for them to partner up with. So it's okay for them to basically put their sticker on something else, because it's not like they're saying, oh, this Ferrari engine's really a Ford engine. There's no inherent competition there. So that's great from Ford's perspective. You've got a ready-made facility to slap your sticker on, try and put some money into, part fund, try and have some technical input to. That's great. And Red Bull, you've got a, I don't want to say like subservient partner, but you've got a partner that respects the fact that they come in on your terms. And I don't see any other scenario that would offer Ford what Red Bull can offer Ford. And I don't really see any other type of manufacturer that'd be willing to accept what Red Bull is imposing. So from that point of view, I hate using the word like synergy or mutually beneficial or anything like that, but it is. I think they might be the only two partners that would tick the boxes that the other one had sort of outlined.
Yeah, it's a good point, that, Scott. And the other interesting thing is about the numbers. If we're to believe what we're hearing from inside, it's in the order of $30 million a year dollars that Ford is paying. And you compare that to Audi, who's reportedly paid $600 million to buy Sauber. It sounds like the bargain of the century, even given the fact that they're only partnering rather than owning it. But then you think back to when Mercedes bought Braun in 2009, not all that long ago, for around 175, and then sold 2/3 of it for more than that. They made a profit of that. And they now, if because obviously the Brixworth part, the engine manufacturing facility costs money, and the Brackley part makes money as the team. And when you subtract one from the other, it's in the order of $60 million a year that it's costing them. So compared to that, you're thinking, well, Ford's paying 50% as much as Mercedes, but only has a share in a team. So in between those two extremes, and also, of course, that's a little bit misleading because in that intervening time, Mercedes invested an awful lot of money in upgrading facilities and keeping up with it and you know, setting the standards. But it's still economically, you can look at it from either side of the divide, and it can look either fantastic value or you can come back to, why just didn't they, as you said earlier on, why didn't they buy the team? You know, why didn't they keep the team and Bosworth back in the day when it was all cheap?
What I like about it, and we've sort of touched on it a little bit there, is that I think it shows to me that there isn't one way for a manufacturer to do F1. Like, I don't think there ever has been, really. You've got your traditional works team, but even the works teams now, like with the exception of Ferrari, you can argue are actually any of them works teams. With Renault, you've got a race team that's basically contracted in England, but the engine's being built in France. With Mercedes, you've got a race team facility in the UK and an engine facility in the UK, and then you've got Daimler out in Germany. How actually integrated is all that? I'm playing devil's advocate there, but so you can poke holes in almost anything. And as I think to take this seriously as a real Ford project, it has to be legitimate that they are going to have a technical input as well as part fund it. You can't just, otherwise it's an engine equivalent of the Alfa Romeo Sauber deal. Now, it might not be a million miles away from that, but that doesn't mean it's not legitimate. It can work, and if this shows that it's okay for Ford to basically be a sort of co-creator of an engine, and then we can call that a manufacturer project, I'm quite interested in the precedent it might set for what Andretti's trying to get over the line with General Motors, because it's not like for like again, and there is a huge distinction in that Ford's going to be working with existing teams and boosting existing teams rather than using it as a way to sneak in an extra team on the grid, which is what some people fear Andretti's trying to do with General Motors. But if you've got it whereby Ford shows that a manufacturer can do F1 by paying a bit of money to say it's an engine supplier, in principle, I do not see how you can argue that General Motors can't pay a bit of money to have an F1 team with Andretti. I see them as broadly similar. And I think the big thing that this has shown to me, it's reinforced what Andretti needs to do, or what Andretti needs to prove that that Cadillac and General Motors will be putting into their project. I don't think they need to show that it's a, you know, equal parts venture, or General Motors is putting up $100 million a year or anything like that. I think they just need to tick the same boxes as Ford and just say it's a proper manufacturer. There's a clear plan to push themselves in the US and maximize the profile and help F1 in the US. There's a decent amount of money being put in, and somewhere down the line, there is potential for there to be legitimate input in what you're creating. On Ford's side, it's supposedly going to be on the ERS and the battery and whatnot. With Cadillac General Motors, it could be on the composition of the race team, or, you know, the technology they use to build their cars or whatever. I don't really believe that they'll be able to influence the Renault 2026 power unit like they've claimed and have IP in it. But there will be other ways in which I'm sure that they can influence that team. So if Cadillac and General Motors can tick those boxes in the same way Ford has, that's another way, another different way for a manufacturer to come into F1. And that's a great way for F1 to capitalize on the interest and the cost effectiveness of the regulations and the landscape and everything. Because it means that manufacturers and interested parties don't have to stump up hundreds and hundreds of millions just to completely outright own an F1 team and build an engine. There's lots of ways to have a bunch of strong teams on the grid with different kinds of manufacturer support.
And ultimately, the days when manufacturers could really directly run their own in-house F1 teams are long gone. You can see that. Use the example of Mercedes. Obviously, Mercedes is a specialist race team, and really, Brixworth is a specialist engineering company that Mercedes acquired and built up. So these are absolutely specialists. It's nothing like it was in the 50s when they did the W196, and that was actually done in Stuttgart. Things have changed so much, you do need this specialism. So this kind of involvement gives the prestige and the badges and the big car companies, because this means F1's got a good number of the biggest car companies in the world, either in or interested in the case of General Motors. So that's a good positive. And the very fact that Stefano Domenicali was on Fox, I've forgotten what show it was this morning, Scott. You're on top of that.
Fox and Friends, I think.
But yeah, that just shows the fact that Ford is coming into Formula One is big news for people who aren't necessarily interested in Formula One. That's very positive. It's just a little bit of a shame that when Domenicali was introduced at the Red Bull launch, which I believe was running a little bit late, he wasn't actually there because he'd had to head off because of his schedule and they were running behind.
It wasn't a good day for Stefano Domenicali being introduced, because when he was on the Fox show, they completely butchered his surname. I think he was announced as Stefano Domencilli or something like that.
Well, hopefully if F1 keeps growing in the US, they'll know his name properly soon enough.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Right, well, Scott, let's get a little bit more into the nuts and bolts of this deal. We have touched on this, but where exactly does the Red Bull Ford Alliance, and we should say the engine will be called Red Bull Ford, lie on a manufacturer spectrum of, say, Alfa Romeo style sponsorship deal with Sauber through to the all-in works operation? Where does it sit?
Oh, it's really difficult to know, because I want to give them the benefit of the doubt and believe that hybrid element input is legitimate. But as Mark said, you do have to take it with a pinch of salt. So I would say on that spectrum, it is closer to the Sauber Alfa Romeo sort of tie up than it is a fully fledged works entry. But I do believe that a manufacturer like Ford, with all the different things that they're involved in motorsport, while they do have a history of being slightly hands off of the way they let things go, I can't believe that they would pay, if it's what, 30 million or whatever it ends up being, I can't believe they would pay that and have their name on something and not want to have some kind of influence over what the end product is. They're going to want to do everything they can to make sure it's successful. So that might be as simple as opening up a few of their facilities, or I think the suggestion that we heard was that Ford intends to have Ford Performance employees embedded full-time in Milton Keynes, working at Rebel Powertrain, stuff like that. So I believe there will be an involvement. Can I say with certainty that it will be 1% of the Rebel Powertrains, or 20%, or as much as half? I've honestly got no idea, but I think it's more than zero, if that's anything.
Yeah, they did also talk about getting involved on the control software side for the hybrid as well, and some of the analysis tools, etc. It's a difficult one to say, because what you definitely don't want as Red Bull is Ford forcing their way into doing stuff. Gary Anderson's got some great stories about Ford doing this back in the day with Jaguar. They wanted to get involved in things they weren't really set up to do and didn't have the specialism for. But I guess, Mark, that's the important thing, isn't it? You need to go to Red Bull Powertrains and say, right, well, what things that Ford may have would you like some support on? And then they can actually work out meaningful ways for any kind of exchange of knowledge or personnel or work to be done in different places off the Milton Keynes campus.
Yeah, well, it's set up in a better way for that than it was back in the Jaguar days, when the tail was wagging the dog. You know, the big corporate people who were new to Formula One came in and told the specialists in F1 how to do F1. And of course, that didn't work. So at least now you're having the big corporate entity coming in as a sponsor. It's not coming in as the owner. So it is in a way set up that the nice pure simplicity of a top racing team in its structure, especially Red Bull, shouldn't be. You know, I'm sure they're not going to let it be too, you know, polluted by values from a completely different type of industry.
That's always a very positive sign for a works manufacturer involved in Formula One. We should note that Ford have said this is an 8-year deal, so that basically starts now with the ramping up towards 2026 and goes through to 2030. So it covers that 2026 to 2030 competition because the full deal will start in terms of on-track stuff in 2026. Scott, one small point of order. What about AlphaTauri?
They're covered as well. So the plan is for AlphaTauri to be supplied by these Red Bull Ford engines from 2026 until 2030. The only caveat I would put on that is while there's no outward sign of Red Bull wanting to sell AlphaTauri, I think given the potential for more manufacturers to come into Formula One, we'll get onto this later, but Honda, for example, are still registered for the 2026 power unit regulations and may yet decide to do something. When you have people like Andretti sniffing around and not being able to get a new entry, when you've got Porsche as well still looking to do something, I don't think I'll ever be fully convinced that Red Bull won't be willing to sell AlphaTauri at some point in the next few years, because I think it's a massive, massive asset. And in a sort of post-Dietrich Mateschitz era, I do wonder if that team's future is sort of ring-fenced in the short, medium term, but longer term could be sold. And obviously, if that did happen, and especially if they partnered with another manufacturer, I don't think they'd want to use a Ford engine. So that's the only, I'd put that little asterisk against AlphaTauri just in the long term.
Yeah, it just comes down to the rising value of F1 teams and whether Red Bull might be making an offer it can't refuse for that team with some of the valuations that are being thrown around, a really motivated buyer. You absolutely never know what might happen with that. But positive for AlphaTauri and for Red Bull, obviously. With AlphaTauri, they've pushed the synergy, as they call it, in terms of parts and components, etc., trying to make sure they maximise that. So it always makes sense those two teams, while they're Red Bull-owned, will have parity in terms of engines. That 1 year when, obviously, Toro Rosso ran the Honda engine after McLaren is kind of an advanced evaluation party, as it were, for Red Bull, was an unusual set of circumstances. But, Mark, you pointed out in a written piece that ran on The Race that this deal has a few distant similarities with the one that led to the all-conquering Ford Cosworth DFE engine. Of course, that's the main reason why Ford's the manufacturer with the fourth most F1 wins, given remarkable success for that engine and its derivatives. Do you think Red Bull has got exactly the right distance to Ford on this one? Cash in and tech if it needs it, but not much interference? And is that DFV model irrelevant one to cite, or is it just because it's Ford and F1 we inevitably reach for it?
Yeah, I think it's more that. It's not the same, but it has, to say, history doesn't repeat, but it sometimes rhymes, and it is more that. And because that was just that was Lotus going to Cosworth and saying how much to make us a state-of-the-art F1 engine. Cosworth saying 100 grand and Lotus going off to find the 100 grand. And they got it from Ford of Britain. So Ford of Britain said, well, if we're paying the money, we'll have the name on the engine. And then because it was so much better than everything else, and they realized that it was probably going to kill F1 if they just kept their exclusive deal, they just made it available to everyone. And that a whole new era of Formula One kicked off. It lasted for decade and a half or more, and put the really solid foundations of F1 down, and that was the foundation that Bernie Ecclestone was able to build upon. It was all built upon the foundation of that Ford Cosworth DFE, where it's similar is that wasn't actually Ford technology, although the Formula 2 engine that the Formula 1 engine was based upon was originally built around the hardware of a Ford production engine, but there was no direct Ford technology going into that. It was purely Cosworth, which is a specialist
engineering company, just as Red Bull Powertrains is. So there's a little bit of a parallel there, but it's not going to be in that model, and it's not, you know, you're not going to have Red Bull selling this engine to anyone to run. You know, I'm sure Red Bull are quite happy with that, but I'm sure Ford paying the money wouldn't be so. It's got certain parallels, and it also, I think it says that the way Ford has always done F1, which is until its disastrous acquisition of the Stewart team and making it into Jaguar, its successful endeavors in Formula One, let's say, have always been in partnership rather than ownership, and I think that's, you know, it's probably a good portent.
Yeah, it's a great irony that although Ford has been so profoundly important in shaping Formula One through that engine, I think Ford has only won two Grand Prix when it's actually owned part of the project. That was one win for Stewart, and obviously it's owned Cosworth at that time, and then one win for Jordan when it was a Ford customer team in 2003. Both Gary Anderson-related ones, funnily enough. But yeah, it's just a curious thing that's worked so well for Ford, and perhaps that's a good omen for the future.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
We'll get back to the pod in a moment, but first, a word about our partner, Grammarly. No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. All those emails, reports, and presentations are equally important to the collaboration needed to get things done, and Grammarly can help. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. I know from experience that Grammarly can help you save time on any writing task and ensure you feel confident about what you've produced. In fact, 96% of Grammarly's users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing, and their tone suggestions can help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done. Well, Scott, you briefly mentioned Honda, so this deal categorically means Honda will not be involved with Red Bull beyond the end of 2025. It has signed up for the 2026 engine rule. So what's the most likely path for Honda from here?
Yeah, this is not to say that what you just said is wrong, but I think the better way to put it is that they've registered their interest in the 2026 rules. And it was strange seeing how the FIA actually characterised that today, because it did say that these manufacturers will compete from 2026 or participate from 2026 to 2030, but it's not a binding agreement. Just because you've registered that interest, it just means you made it in time for the deadline and you can be factored into planning for 2026, you can be involved in the regulatory discussions, blah, blah, blah. But it's no binding commitment. So Honda's not obligated now to race in Formula One just because the FIA has them on a list of registered interested parties. What it means is that, as I think we've talked about before, and as was made clear at the end of last year, Honda is taking the prospect of a 2026 project very seriously, and it has done everything it needs to do in terms of ticking boxes to basically be able to crack on with one of those projects when it makes its mind up. But it hasn't. As I understand it, there is still no final decision from Honda to participate in Formula One beyond 2025 when this continuation deal with Red Bull and AlphaTauri to supply them with engines comes to an end. What we need to know now from Honda is, do they have time to do the project the way they want? And how exactly do they envisage it working? If they decide to build an engine, they need a team. So you've now lost your best partner because it was the one that you were already working with and was doing really well with. Is there another team on the grid that would want to go with them? I think there is. I've heard of
I've heard that at least one non-Red Bull team has made an initial contact with Honda just to sort of see what they're up to for 2026. I don't think that Honda will try and enter a works team, so I don't think they'll be part of this expressions of interest to the FIA. So I think their options are fairly limited, and like I say, they still need to decide. One of the problems is that they are short on time, because I've written about this quite a lot, but it does feel like something that a lot of people overlook. Just because Red Bull are continuing to, you know, assemble, maintain, look after the Red Bull engines or the two Red Bull teams' engines, it doesn't mean that they actually have like a fully functional F1 operation. You know, as I understand it, Sakura has been gutted over the last sort of year or so. The original reason for withdrawing from F1 at the end of 2021 officially was for Honda to redirect resources to their zero emissions project as part of their, you know, carbon neutrality goals as an automotive company. And that included personnel as well as money. So I don't think Sakura is as well stocked for F1 sort of caliber engineers as it needs to be. There are other elements as well, like they had a facility in the UK that was manufacturing the ERS, but that was basically not given, but I think it was sold to Red Bull to be absorbed into Red Bull powertrains. So Honda don't have that facility, so they need to work out a way to manufacture an ERS. And now, because we're into 2023, anything they do is subject to the cost cap rules for engine manufacturers for 2026. So they've got a limit to what they can spend on capital expenditure and that kind of thing. So it's not simple for Honda to get an engine ready and to be on the grid in some way in 2026. I think it's still possible, but I don't think it's very likely. And I've been rambling for a while, but my final point would be, it's so frustratingly Honda for them to be in a completely self-inflicted position like this, where they forced their best engine, their best partner, into a long-term plan that excludes Honda and that another manufacturer will benefit from. All of this is because of Honda's own actions. So you talk about Red Bull, you talk about Ford would have saved themselves a load of aggro, or Red Bull would have saved themselves a load of aggro if there could have been a nice little deal back in 2004 for it all to just be one big shiny project, Red Bull and Cosworth. Honda would just have solved so much aggro for themselves if they'd just been patient in 2020, not panicked in response to their lack of preparation around new technologies, not panicked in response to the pandemic. If they'd just been patient, they would have ridden that out, realised how much success they were going to have, and then stayed in F1 with Red Bull long term. And instead, you've got Red Bull announcing the perfect, perfect engine deal for them, really, at a time where Honda has no idea if it'll be on the grid in 26 or not.
Almost like what happened at the end of 2008, where if they'd just been patient, would have had a world championship the following year, and with it, that team went on to break all the records.
What's the common denominator here? What could it possibly be?
It's just history rhyming again, isn't it? To come back to what Mark was saying earlier. But yeah, I can imagine Honda will be very tempting for anyone who needs an engine partner. There's a few obvious teams who I imagine will be lobbying with them. But I guess we should just ask Scott, why don't you think Red Bull and Honda ended up continuing? Because there was talk about that, and there was a point where it looked like that was the most likely course of action.
So one point is something that Mark mentioned earlier, which I think is spot on. The Red Bull can't hang around forever. I don't think Honda has made a decision, and I don't think Red Bull really liked that uncertainty. And I wonder if what I was saying about how ready can Honda actually be for 26, what quality of work can be expected of them if they've reduced their capacity in Japan. I wonder if that maybe put a bit of a doubt in Red Bull's mind. There were talks last year. Definitely, it was on the agenda when they met in Japan around the Japanese Grand Prix. That was in September, October time. So I think there would have been a little bit of a push factor away from Honda. And I think there was a pull factor towards Ford because it just ticked the boxes in the way that Honda didn't. And I think there is also the possibility that Honda itself wasn't convinced that a Red Bull Powertrains collaboration worked, because it would only have been on the hybrid side. You know, Red Bull Powertrains was tooled up. There was a load of money spent for it to be able to build the V6 and do some other stuff, but primarily the V6. So I don't think Red Bull would have budged on that. And I don't think that would have been enough for Honda when Sakura's expertise is in combustion. It is that's the technology that their ace is at. And obviously, hybrid stuff, battery, would fit in with their zero emissions target. But it's just a bit more of a limited involvement. There's a possibility that that didn't really appeal to Honda.
Well, Mark, we should briefly talk about the fact the FIA did announce the six manufacturers had signed up for 2026 to 2030 power units rules. Obviously, they wanted to get on the back of the Red Bull Ford announcement and shout about the interest in F1. The others are obviously Alpine, Ferrari, Mercedes, Audi, Honda. Porsche is obviously conspicuous by its absence when it comes to this. So what should we take from that?
Just that it is not in a position to do anything really at the moment. That doesn't mean that it can't come in. I think to the strict letter of the regulations, it means they don't have an input into forming the regulations. But I think even that is not a hard set rule if you had agreement from the others. So it doesn't mean that we're definitely not going to see them just because they're not on this list. But at the moment, there's not a really obvious way for them to come in a satisfactory way. They don't have time to create their own power unit. You would think the logical thing would be to take the in-house power unit from Audi and rename it, which there's nothing stopping them from doing that in terms of the Formula One regulations, as long as that power unit is still subject to one cost cap, and not two lots of expenditure permitted on development. But what is their way in? Do they buy an existing team? Well, there's only a couple of them around that would be potentially up for sale at the moment. They're very, very high value, and would certainly put them behind their group. Their sister company Audi, in terms of where the starting point was, and that, given that Porsche is nominally the more prestigious of the two brands, Porsche and Audi, it's probably a difficult thing for them to wear to start, you know, several steps behind their stablemate, and so yeah, it's fraught with difficulty the route to Formula to Porsche coming into Formula One. Just through circumstance and the way that it's all panned out, but I wouldn't say we're definitely not going to see them. I think that there's still a will from them to find a way in, but it's very difficult to see what that would be at the moment. Things change very quickly.
And it'd be very naive, as you say, to imagine that if Porsche suddenly said, right, we're going to do something, the FIA and F1 would say, no, you can't do it. You're too late. That's just not how it works. So the door is pretty much open for as long as they need it to be. But yeah, since that Red Bull thing fell over, it's hard to see Porsche finding a way to do it, certainly without using the Audi engine. And that raises all the complexities you mentioned, Mark.
Well, I think that the only way that Porsche can come in now is if it focuses on being the team, and there is just a sort of an element of neutrality on the engine side, in that the VW group says we want this to happen, so Audi, you have to supply Porsche, you have to take it from Audi, and Porsche just buys into Williams. I still think that, I mean, you need Doralton to probably lower the amount that they'd be asking for, and Doralton says it's not actively looking to sell the team, but it would be a huge project for Porsche, because clearly there are problems there, quite deep-rooted problems at Williams. But if you look at the other options on the grid, like McLaren, for example, they don't want to sell a stake in the team. Certainly not a stake that would give a manufacturer like that authority, and the overriding authority. So then what else is there? I don't really see that there's anyone other than Williams that would really work. So Porsche's best bet now might be to go down that route and just work out what needs to be done to make the most competitive team possible and not really worry about the engine side. But I don't know how that really matches with the ambitions of a manufacturer that clearly wants to have technological input and be able to put something like a hybrid engine project in the same way that they're in Formula E at the centre of what they're doing, and be able to show off that they're a forward-thinking brand and company at the cutting edge of incredible technology. So they're going to have to sacrifice something, aren't they, if they want to get on the grid? I don't see how Porsche can come into F1 now on its own terms.
Yeah, and it would seem very, very odd if they were to do anything that wasn't involving doing what seemed to be their own engine. At least Red Bull, with its powertrains division, offered that possibility for it to be badged Porsche, which would have had an effect, especially with an ownership stake. But yeah, not many opportunities for them there. But I guess we should circle back round to Red Bull, Mark, because we've said how great all of this is. They've got Ford. They've invested heavily in setting up the powertrains company. Actually, technically, it's two companies because there's Red Bull Powertrains and there's Red Bull Powertrains 2026. So I think they've split them to make it nice and easy to tell the difference between the current program and the 2026 one, which makes sense from accounting and cost cap measures. But that's still a big ask. We're all assuming Red Bull will get it right because Red Bull does get it right. They've invested heavily. Loads of good people there, all the best kit. But we shouldn't lose sight of how big an ask this is. Just because Red Bull engines have won 17 Grand Prix or whatever, they're Honda engines. Honda's going to be gone. There might have been a bit more of a comfort blanket effect if they continued with Honda, because Honda had a bit more expertise, current F1 expertise, to feed into it. But now it's thoroughly on its own, isn't it? So, big test.
It is a big test. It's no small thing to go from a standing start to making competitive Grand Prix engines. The only thing I'd say is that a lot of the people they've recruited are very, very experienced at creating these sort of engines. So it's in a sense, it's almost just like making a teamwork and just getting the talent that you've got. We're all working getting them aligned and working in the same direction. So I it's not like they're taking a load of sort of virgin engineers and saying, okay, create an F1 engine, go. They've taken on a lot of they've recruited a lot of very, very experienced people.
Yeah, you'd expect it to go well, but it's just one of those things that makes me wonder, Scott, that if it starts off badly, Ford's going to be putting pressure on as well, because it's going to be Ford on the cam cover. Yeah, it'll be Red Bull Ford, but people are going to be talking about it as a Ford engine. So even though there's lots of good upside there for not much investment for Ford, there is also downside, because if engines start blowing up, they're not very good, and you have kind of, I don't know, Max Verstappen yelling about a GP2 engine to invoke an old Alonso quote, it could be quite embarrassing, couldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But that just comes back to what I was saying earlier. I can't imagine that a manufacturer like Ford would allow or would be willing to put its name to something and then allow itself to be completely at the mercy of that organisation. It will want to have the possibility to at least influence it in some way. The only way that would be incorrect for me to view it that way is if Ford is so naive that they think that they can just throw this money at it as a sponsorship deal because they just consider Rebel Powertrains to be a sure thing in terms of competitiveness. But I can't imagine that is actually the case. So no, if it's not successful, Ford will obviously want answers, and they'll want to be able to change that as soon as possible. But I think that just increases the likelihood that Ford will throw everything that realistically they can to help Red Bull Powertrains make the most competitive engine possible.
Yeah, and I think it's likely to go well. As long as they do the powertrains project a little bit better than they run their launches, they should be absolutely fine. Well, thanks very much, Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. If you enjoyed listening to us, we have got our first live podcast in London on February the 12th. Check the link in the description, as there's tickets still available there. There's a special offer available for anyone who wants to come along. Do head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen, plenty to read there, and also have a look at our various podcasts, including Bring Back V10s, our IndyCar podcast, Formula E, etc., and also check out our YouTube channel. Our next podcast will be about the season launch Williams is holding on Monday. Again, that won't be a new car, but hopefully they'll have the decency to be honest about it. So stay with us for everything you need to know from Williams.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.